Welcome to The Evidence-Based Therapist, a podcast where we read so you don't have to.
Here you'll find three therapists discussing cutting-edge research articles, explaining why and how people work together to find healing.
Welcome back to The Evidence-Based Therapist, where we read so you don't have to. Melissa, Caleb, and myself, Bridger, are here in the studio today to talk about another article in our series on embodiment and in
somatics.
Yeah.
This article that we're getting ready to read is from the Journal of Psychological Perspectives, copyrighted by the Jungian Institute of Los Angeles.
Well, that's cool already.
Yeah. Says a lot about it. From Rutledge, which is a favorite.
Yeah, which we talked about.
You guys see why I chose this article. Like when I found it, I'm like, it's tasty.
It is a wedding.
Yes.
But the title is Psyche Within the Matrix of the Natural World, Emergence, Restoration, and Sustainability by Barbara Hollyfield. This article talks in a way that none of the other articles up to now have.
That's right.
And so it's important for us to, you know, even in just introducing this article, to preface that for you. I hope you all go and read it, because it's a very different experience.
Very easy reading.
Yes. Yes. And very imaginative.
Yeah,
it stokes something curious in you. And so in that, we're going to have this sort of tandem kind of going between what it means clinically and what it means even just functionally as humans.
Yes.
To really remember what is eco-psychology, what is eco-somatics, and how are we as humans to try and make sense of our relationship to ourselves and the earth and each other. So it's going to have a little bit of a different feel, because it's not based on the quote-unquote scientific publication requirements of here's your introduction, your lit review, your now sample, and on and on. But it is a case study of a moment.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah. I just love, like, just to take a second of, like, because part of this podcast is orienting therapists to the beauty of the academic field, which we hold, but we also know, like, gets objectified very easily.
And
it's hard to, like, it's hard to get into that, like, pool and enjoy the water.
But a lot of people don't know that this kind of thing exists there too.
Well, that's what I was saying. Like,
even the way we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This article is like a, again, it's from the Jungian Institute of LA. So, like, there's a lot of, like, analytic, creative, metaphorical liberty in that sort of writing. Because if you think back all the way to Freud, Freud is using his, I mean, he's a neurologist, but he uses so much metaphor and his understanding of the world as he's experienced it to make sense of his theories.
Because it's more than I can put into a single word.
Yeah. Like, so much of, I mean, this is analysis, psychoanalysis at its most core was based on observation and interpretation.
Yep.
And so, like, this article feels that rhythm of she goes in and out of observing and then interpreting, observing and interpreting. She uses the natural world. She uses the psychological world. Like, it's such a beautiful dance, but it is qualitatively so much different.
Yes.
To read this than it is to go read a random control trial where I'm kind of like skimming through the methods to make sure it's legit. I'm kind of skimming through like some of the kind of results.
Did you skim any of this article?
I did not skim a single part. I even looked at the piece of art, which is fully printed on the second page.
Yes.
But I'm not, I wasn't doing that. I was in it. And then I like made a comment in a Moat episode we recorded on this just before this of how like there's so many notes that I have in the margin, because this sort of style just brings up something different, and then there's a creativity in play. So I say all that to say, like, I love analytic writing, and to include it in the academic field may help some of our readers get this sense of like vitality and curiosity and creativity that may feel lacking in places like strict random control trials or more quantitative research, although I still argue that that's there. But
I was gonna say, to me, no, like, to me, it is there. I agree that it's not taught in so many circles. And the amount of comments I get about this podcast where it's like, if I had this type of conversation in my graduate program, I would love research. Mm-hmm. I just didn't even know that this was
that possible this was to talk this way. Yes.
To create community around things. Yeah. Even the most positivist of quantitative designs out right. there is still this reality behind it.
Well, so what's fascinating here is that we're talking about the way that the subject of this article is talked about, because it is very illuminating. The reality is that somatic research almost has to be done this way to some degree, mm-hmm. because of the nature of what it is. It's very, very difficult to put down in more empirical and what we would consider the usual academic way. How do you measure and communicate and, you know, bring method to that sort of embodied and individual experience? It gets really dang tricky. Mm. And it is possible, but you also lose a lot in translation. And so the favored method of communicating and researching more somatic ways of working in our field is actually this very qualitative, almost like when you read it, there's this feeling of, I'm not sure if I'm reading prose or poetry or research right now, which is wonderful. And that's because that is how we get into a more right brain embodied experience. And when we're talking about something that has to do with somatics in the body, it demands that we get comfortable using this way of communicating, because it evokes exactly what the writer is wanting to evoke in the body of the reader. Mm. And so it's a good place to start in terms of, this has to be written this way in order to really bring forward the point of what she's trying to say. Mm-hmm. If she wrote about it in a very black and white, theoretical, high-level way, it would not bring the same evoked sense that this way of communicating does at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I thought that potentially an important starting point would be to introduce people to the main idea of this article, because it's a very new one, and it's the area of ecosomatics, which at this point, there's not a settled name for this because it is so new. So you'll hear it called ecosomatics, you'll hear it called ecopsychology, you'll also hear it called somacology. They're technically all the same thing. But because there's, you know, a diversity of thinkers that are bringing this forward at the same time, there isn't necessarily a decided upon language yet. Mm. I think it'll get there, and which one will be chosen, I have no idea. But in the meantime, you guys can know that it's really all looking at the same thing, slightly different fractal faces of the same issue, but really all getting to the same core desire of having a way of looking at the combination of body, earth, and consciousness. Whether you call that consciousness spirit or mind doesn't really matter. In this context, she's looking very much at the way that the client understands her selfhood in combination with her physical body in relationship with the natural world.
Yeah,
so it's the coming together. Yes.
Because I think that that's so important in the telling of this narrative and the way that the author really puts together each sentence.
Yeah.
It's so intentional and honoring to the lived experience of both her and the client.
Yes.
And their relationship.
And... Yeah. Yeah. And the unfolding of it.
Yeah.
There's this very progressive nature to it. So it's not a stagnant experience. It's not a identification of this happened. It's really this... kind of evolving moment that you're kind of carried along with in the article, which is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So where do you guys want to go with it?
I highlighted a question that she asks. She starts the kind of article talking about a story with seeing like a herring. Is it a herring?
Falcon.
Heron. Yeah. Oh, and then a falcon and the heron's eating kind of like a mouse or some sort of
furry creature. We need to say what we're really talking about. It's like, wait, the author of this empirical journal started off by talking about a heron eating a...
Yes, she did. Yeah.
So she talks about this walk that she takes before she sees a client.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the intro. It's literally like, this morning I walked down a quiet valley to where it streams, to where its stream lets out into a small bay. That's the first sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. And she tells this story she talks about how she,
what she's seeing.
And we could spin up on this if you want. Yeah. But the question comes after. So do we want to spin up on this, the part? Because I also
I just wanted to contextualize like what you just said for the reader.
Right.
Yeah. So she asked the question after kind of following the story.
It's the same question.
And then the story goes on to like be further illuminated through her interaction with her client later. But she asks, what might emerge if we adjusted our listening perspective to carefully hear what our patients experience in their relationship to nature? Yes. Would we want to? If we listen and facilitate a deeper exploration, do we believe it will draw us away from the necessary work of intra and interpersonal material? Do we hear patients' feelings about the earth as resistance or displacement? Could these feelings instead be a root of psychic suffering? If we truly heard, might prophetic visions arise about what is deeply desired, desires to restore what is wounded and live in dignity with each other and the land? So really, like, my thought goes to that first question. What might emerge if we adjusted our listening perspective to carefully hear what our patients experience in relationship to nature? And that, like, to me, I think you could meditate on that for weeks.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I've been thinking, and this is like a callback to the last episode where we talked about when language of clients drifts towards totally abstract. So they're no longer using those lower mental, mental capacities and learning to inform the higher mental capacities, but they're just in the realm of high detachment, deep abstractions where they're using lots of it's, that, all of the very kind of impersonal language. And like how that connects to this idea of like in the 21st century, like how often are we in places and spaces and invading kind of daily rhythms that are abstracted,
yeah,
that are impersonal.
I love like in that the starting of the paragraph before the quote or the idea shared from Barry Lopez, suggesting that we are autistic in relation to the natural world.
Oh my gosh,
autistic in the sense that our deepest experiences are never voiced and thus remain encapsulated and undeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right after that she asked the question of the reader, like, and of herself even, do we want to know?
Yeah.
And are they aware themselves? And in that disposition, like, dang it, the psychoanalytic tradition is so cool.
Yeah.
Like even the word autistic.
Yeah.
In this way, I'm thinking of all of these different authors that talk about this autistic position.
The autistic position.
Yeah, of not knowing.
Yeah.
Your own sense of rootedness in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This sensation of being separate from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we all highlighted that section.
Yeah.
And you know, right after that, there's one more question, and when I read it, there was sort of this realization of she's stating it from the psychoanalytic tradition, but we could almost substitute one word and look at it from every other tradition and ask the same question. So the question is, do we privilege dream over the direct experience in the living world? And so that's the psychoanalytic tradition, but we could look at it from a CBT perspective and say, do we privilege cognition, right? Over the direct experience in the living world. What do we privilege as a therapist? What do we consider valid material for our sessions with our clients? And I think one of the beautiful things that, number one, the field of ecosomatics is attempting to highlight, but then also this article in a very specific way, is believing and feeling that our relationship to the natural world and the emotions and the sensations that it evokes in us is incredibly rich material to work with in therapy. In the same way that we've been discussing for a long time, that the intersubjective space between us and the client is incredibly important material to be focused on in therapy. Also then too, is their intersubjective space between them and the natural world,
mm-hmm.
right? The way that they come into relationship with it, experience it, are provoked by it, and then act upon it. Like all of that is incredibly valid. And I think that is so incredibly impactful for us to feel permission to really engage with that.
Yeah.
And we're kind of doing that in some bizarre ways, not bizarre ways, but very interesting kind of back doorways, things like involving animals in therapy, et cetera. Well, why do we think that's relevant at all? Mm-hmm. And this is beginning to really get to the core of why does that make the impact that it does?
Well, so, and I like your distinction between, you know, replacing dream with cognition, because mm-hmm. I think it highlights what I would say, even as an undergraduate student, what I thought of things like adventure-based therapy.
Right.
Like it was to create a different environment for the therapeutic dyad, which was the point.
Yeah.
Which I feel is like sort of an intuitive, simple idea that, mm-hmm. oh, you're going to go like do a ropes course or go on an adventure-based hike.
And it'll give you something interesting to talk about.
Like, oh, you can overcome that. Think of all the other things that you can overcome.
And all of the analogies that we can draw from this experience to this experience. Yeah. Right.
But instead, what I've come to learn, even from the analytic tradition, is the power of projective identification. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about metaphor that's not related to an embodied experience. I'm talking about
metaphor that is.
That is embodied experience. Yes. That is projective identification, just as she goes on to talk about the case that we'll get into. The patient starts to use language describing a scene that isn't just metaphor. She's in the scene. She's really describing a mirror that she sees of herself.
Yes.
And that to me is the difference between detached, as you were saying, Caleb, like detached,
abstracted,
just total abstraction, and embodied projective identification.
Well, and so I would push that even one step further, and now this moves into the transpersonal realm, right? But I always go there, and so I will. That we can actually let that be entirely literal. So the mirror is us.
Yeah.
Right. We really are seeing us. And from a transpersonal perspective, when I, you know, go out and, you know, go for a hike and have these moments with nature where I feel profoundly connected and my body is reacting to the natural world that I'm in interaction with, the transpersonal perspective is I am in reaction to it because it is me. Mm. Right. And it is reacting to me that we are in this dynamic with each other because we are the same stuff. We are the same matter. We are the same material. And so it's not just about seeing myself in a reflection that, you know, gives me something to then ponder later, but it's about me actually seeing a new facet of myself, that the natural world is me.
Yeah.
It's the moment of standing in the forest and going, there I am. You know, here I am and there I am. And then to see another human in the midst of that, and we get these really profound encounters and the client walks away going, I don't really know what just happened, but I know that I feel different. Mm-hmm. I feel more expanded. I feel more connected. I at once have the sensation of being more fully an individual, but less alone than ever. And what is that about?
Yeah.
Right. And it's really about that feeling of the natural world teaches us about the material that we're really made of because we're made of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the literal interpretation of ecosomatics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking about, like, I have two thoughts. One of is that idea of, you know, why do we bring animals into therapy? And it's, you know, I experience it as a moment in which, like, the client can like resist really hard, which happens, but more often than not, it's this instigation of their pre-verbal infantile self that is learning rather than remembering.
Yeah.
So it's an experiencing self rather than a remembering historical self.
Right.
And so they're open to like, I have to use something other than, and see myself in other ways than language. Mm-hmm. Or the abstraction, the symbolic abstraction of language with this dog or with this horse or in nature.
Yeah.
And in the article, she talks about when she sees that she's having this moment where she's watching the heron eat like a mouse or whatever. And then this falcon comes and starts like cawing at the heron and is like, there's this kind of battle happening. And then she says this line, like aware of an inner pulsing, wordless reflection, realizing I had unexpectedly become part of the hunt.
Yes.
And I like love this because then she goes on to see how with her client, the same sort of pulsing realization a wordless reflection of what was happening in the therapy was she had become a part of the hunt with the client.
Well, yeah, exactly. Potential threat, silent witness. Soon I will be at my office with a week ahead of analytic practice.
Yeah.
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 That willingness to enter into this, like, sorting out of doer or done to, and then the third idea, the complementarity. Like, Benjamin is all over this thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, that's so many connections that I made.
Jessica about, Benjamin.
Sorry. Yeah. But the connections between the metaphor, the true embodied metaphor, and watching then how that can not only show insight to the case, which it does,
right,
but also help you really know it and feel it because you're actually seeing it happen.
Yeah.
In everywhere you look.
Yeah.
Well, and I think like that is part of the beauty of interacting with the natural world is that it has no desire, mechanism, etc., to objectify a human being. The natural world sees us, and that's a huge anthropomorphization, which you guys know what I mean there. Like, the natural world subsumes us because we are part of it. And so that you know, phrase, I found myself becoming part of the hunt, is because the natural world does not separate, right? There that is a human thing that we do to each other that is found in no other space and place in the natural world. And so entering into a dynamic with a horse, with a dog, with a tree, we have this opportunity to feel a full subjectification because that natural entity does not have the ability to objectify us. It does not have that desire or capacity. And so it produces a sensation in us that is very different than a human interaction.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the point of this case that she's getting at is talking about the relationship between the earth and her and this client, this patient who is, as she says in the article, a survivor of very intense childhood abuse.
Yeah.
And so much of the language that she starts to pay attention to and what she sees both in the patient and in the world that she's subsumed by, just as you said, Melissa, is about this carnage of Mother Earth.
Yeah.
And seeing how that so beautifully and tragically both mirrors and joins the patient and her in this analytic dance.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think like I don't know, there's something so profound about learning universality directly from the earth versus talking about it as a concept through the human mind. The embodied experience of connection through a natural encounter does something in a human being that, you know, language about it just cannot do. And I think that is part of why, Bridger, is that feeling of the natural world embodies and holds all of the dark and the light of our experience, the carnage of it and the joy and the beauty of it, the exuberance and the creativity and the death and the decay is all there laid out in front of us. And yet at the same time, it finds tremendous balance and gentleness and nurturing. And so I think it's those kinds of experiences that people have with the natural world that help them reconceptualize their own experiences in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mind keeps going to, like the idea of like the difference between standing in the woods and standing in a street filled with buildings and like the experience of like deadness versus aliveness.
Yeah.
And in a way, like the dissociation, dissociation as like a way of sort of killing or dehumanizing or deactivating things in a way to find a palpable amount of life. And in cities, this like unconscious acculturation that happens to our bodies, which is that like there's so much that's not moving. Like if statues started to move, we'd all freak out.
Right.
We kind of like statues because they stay still.
They are object.
And we like we like buildings because they're predictable. Mm-hmm. And when it is Zizek. And when a building like falls, we all are like, what the heck? That was supposed to stay up forever.
Yeah.
And we find ways to keep that going. But in nature, there's this always like changing and moving energy.
Yeah.
There's this life that is nonlinear
and cyclical, seasonal.
Yeah. And it's, she talks about, the author talks about her, client who's named Renee, which is an alias, moving out into like the a patch of land where she could dig in the earth. And she notes that having a patch of land that was hers had been enormously significant in her finding a path out of dissociation. And then in italics, she listened and responded to an inner voice that had been all but beaten down by competing and attacking points of view.
Yeah.
So, and I wrote like ideologies. Ideologies want to impose desire that that tell you what you ought to do and feel and be, which is also like in the cityscape, you have streets that tell you where you ought to go and be, where you need to, what you need to do, what directions. Whereas out in nature, life is like beautifully interwoven, but not as directional. And like, to me, it feels really important to somehow make that connection between like my embodied experience of dissociation is very similar to the difference between a cityscape and the woods.
Right. Which is to me, so why it's so powerful and why so often natural experiences are so evocative and thus kind of almost like, revelationary, like you discover something in that, because just as in this patient story, they reconnect with, and the patient finds access to herself in this land.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking care of it, even, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but even by taking care of it, she rediscovers her own identity in it. Mm-hmm. And finding the desire and the hope and the truly the peace of being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's so tragic, but it's so human.
Yeah.
And somatic in that way.
It wasn't in this article, but in a similar article that I read, they were talking about the literal mirroring that happens when we are doing healing work with the earth. And I thought about it when they were describing, you know, the client's experience of going into the land and like sticking her hands in the dirt. And it's this phrase of the earth is always saying to us, this is who you are. Mm. And so much of the psychic craving of our clients and of all humans is for somebody to tell us, who am I? Like, what am I? You know, what is my purpose? What is the stuff that I am made of? And so the desire for a very living mirror, a mirror that has something profound to offer us, we find it in the natural world in ways that is just hard to put language to.
Right.
And that ineffable quality is actually one of the features that require some qualitative language and research is because it is so embodied that language just sort of gets stumped and and we don't know where to go with it. And so we do things like art and dance and music and building things and cooking things because we have to show and express what this living mirror has birthed within me, has woken up within me. And there's so much about that kind of experience that is just super hard to translate in language. Mm. And in the therapeutic dynamic, because language is so much of what we do, learning how to sink into that moment to moment, body to body, very visceral way of interacting is how we produce these same kind of living mirror experiences with our client. In that way, we as therapists have a lot to learn from the very quiet but powerful mirroring that the earth does for people. It's this way of saying, this is what you are. I don't have to tell you in language. I'm just going to sit here in the center of myself and show you in this way. Yeah.
In the story of the article, like what you're talking about is exactly like a point that I wanted to get to where, you know, the author is talking about how Renee, the client, then after some time of doing really well on this plot of land, starts to then question everything. And she starts to question God.
Deintegrate. I love that word.
Deintegrate. Yeah. From that state of deintegration in which we worked at, with the primitive agonies of early abandonment, she emerged with an inner foundation that had more solidity and from which she could grow. We could spend a whole hour on that. But I wanted to get to like what you're talking about, Melissa, where, you know, when we have a lot to learn as therapists from, the natural world.
Yes.
So again, the author says the same day that she encountered the heron and the falcon is the same day she had this session with Renee, in which Renee was questioning God, trying to, and was talking about, like, I want to cling to you, the therapist, the more I let go of God, the more I feel this, like, letting go of God, the more I want to cling to you as a therapist. But then she said she also wants to prove God. Mm-hmm. She also wants to, like, cling to that as well. So there's this, like, back and forth in the client. And then she says, the encounter with the falcon and the heron and the mole, situates me in a community of living beings, a community of diversity and wildness of which I can lose track in my very peopled world. I'm glad to be brought down to size, so to speak, before entering the analytic hour with Renee as she wonders about God. And this is, like, the very important part that I feel so strongly about. It is keeping me settled so as not to get drawn into words and ideological constructs that would take her away from her experience. Like, how I resonate with that so much in my own experience, but also with clients of
in my practice.
Could run on ideological constructs and I could fill 7 intensives with ideological constructs.
Let me teach you some things about yourself and your mind.
And even, like,
and we're good at that. We can just to talk do that.
About what we're talking about for hours.
That's right.
But like there's this experience of being in the room. And, like, I think of Professor Slughorn's, like, in Harry Potter, where his, like, hourglass turns and it goes slowly.
Yes.
Where I could, that would go so fast if I talked about ideological constructs, but to be connected to my embodied experience and the world around me brings me into this room in a space where it's actually tremendously slow. And I just stick with, let's, like, we could talk about if God is good, then why do bad things happen and all that, all those ideological constructs. But what's your experience in this moment of clinging and the desire to cling?
Yeah, because as she was even saying that, like, are you talking about God? Are you talking about your mother? Like, that's so much of, like, that
all absent, of it,
but punishing with her absence of her feared mother. Like, that's, you know, in the article she's talking about, that's one of the components of her case and how that really just finds itself playing over and over and over again in every area of Renee's mind, in what she's seeing, here it is, and it's showing itself back to her, and in how she's organizing her past experience, how she's organizing her experience of the therapist. It's all there. This absent but angry, but real but not,
but the clinging to it.
But I must have, but I can't.
And everything in me, like, when I, that word clinging, if that word was brought out in a session, I mean, I could spend like half an hour with the word clinging and all of the sensation that somebody feels in connection to that kind of word and what that produces in them. And I'm, like, so conscious as we talk about this, you guys, of most therapists have no freaking idea how to be in this kind of moment with somebody, because this is not how we were trained. And so it feels important to say, like, we're working on solutions to really begin to demonstrate this way of being with other humans, and particularly our clients. And the audio format is just not the spot to do that. And so we're looking at video options, and all of that is coming really, really soon, because we're very conscious of, as we talk about this way of being with clients, there is likely a craving in people listening to this to see what we actually mean. Like, what does this look like? To go that slow and to track that precisely with a client, what their moment-to-moment embodied experience
Direct experience.
The here and now, and how do we stay out of those high-level theoretical, you know, cognitive conversations, but still have rich, meaningful, full sessions.
Well, yeah, and in that, I would, like, to me, it feels like not just stay out of, but to contextualize them,
right?
Not to just let them be adrift in the soup of abstraction,
right?
But to say, no, this cognitive stuff matters only because it's emergent from the somatic,
right? How do we always go back there? Like, how do we let the body have the final say in whatever we're doing and talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in SIP, we talk about that a lot, of always circling back around and anchoring in the body, et cetera. And so that's built into the way that we work. But I think that this way of talking about our work with our clients is probably very new to a lot of people. Yeah. And so all of that to say, we're not done talking about it because it feels that important to us.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Is it okay if I read another quote?
Yeah. That's probably a good spot to wrap up too.
Yeah. Cause she says, indwelling in the body and dwelling in direct experience, which, like, when we talk about this, like the difference between bottom up or top down or overly cognitive sessions, overly abstracted sessions, or are we embodied? Are we connected? Are we with our direct experiences? Like, that's what she's talking about. Are both of us in the inner subjective space inhabiting our bodies and sitting with our direct experience? She says, and dwelling in the body, dwelling in direct experience with one's earth cuts through dissociative splitting, anchors one in relation to a wisdom that is derived from a felt knowing. And earlier she talked about, like, in the idea of, like, being kind of cut off. I want to just go back to it. She says, in the being autistic, uh-huh, in our relationship to the world, she says, yet for a voice to emerge, there must be one who listens.
Yes.
And if there's one thing this, like, article did for me was, one, as a therapist, like, situating myself in the room as, like, in a way embodying nature as the one who listens.
Yes.
And invites the client to come into a space of, like, attuned listening. But then also to encourage clients and myself to go out into nature, mm-hmm, and to see, like, in the scene of myself in nature, like, that is not without nature listening to me.
Yes. That's right.
And seeing me, you said that, like, yeah, anthropomorphically, but I would almost say, like, literally, nature, yes, sees me,
yes,
and makes way for me to see parts of myself, like the most destructive parts of myself, that's the right, most beautiful parts of myself, the most cocooning and shelling parts of myself, the most hidden, the most illuminated, like, all parts of me get seen in nature. Mm-hmm. And then in sessions, like, can I be the one who listens to my client? Mm-hmm. And that is the thing, sitting with that direct experience, that cuts through dissociative splitting and anchors us in a wisdom that is from a felt knowing. Mm-hmm. And that just feels like, oh, this article.
Mm-hmm. Well, so clearly we need to do a whole training series where we take therapists out into nature and let nature teach them how to do therapy. I mean, we're going to do that, right?
Sounds right.
Sounds about right. We'll work on that, guys. Well, thank you for a beautiful conversation.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, this is not about the article, because if I start talking about it again, we're just going to go another week. But to me, it's just so beautiful to have the diversity of literature reflected already.
So beautiful.
There's like 18 episodes of this podcast, yes, because this is really what it's about.
Yeah.
It's so much about, what are people saying? Mm-hmm. How are they talking?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What are they talking about?
Yeah.
That to me, I know those seem like simple questions, but they're so, so curious to, mm-hmm, me. And like with my research students, that's really what I want them to catch.
Oh yeah.
Like, I don't care like what your project turns into. I really don't. Mm-hmm. And I know that's infuriating to you because you're just trying to do this for the grade right now. But like, aren't you interested?
Yeah.
Can't you hear and see and feel what it is that you're trying to observe, and mm-hmm, how are you going to talk about that? Mm-hmm. How do you think other people have talked about that?
Yeah. So speaking of that, my top pick for the next article that we do in this series of somatics, because I think we have one more. Is that right?
I don't think so.
I think we were done.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we might do a moat about
you could
this
do it. Then. You could do a shout out to the listeners, and we will know the OGers who go and read this article.
Well, yeah. Okay. Okay. So if you want another article like this one, where this one focused on ecosomatics, there is a woman that is a chair of a prestigious university named Claire Wills, Wills. And she writes in a very similar fashion, but it's about dance. And it's all about the metaphor, but also the literal embodied experience of dance
as a therapeutic tool in her own personal life, and the way that the interplay between humans in that situation just produces all kinds of illumination about what it means to be a human being in relationship. So go find Claire Will's article called Stepping Out, and you're welcome.
maybe that's people's, like for those of you who are bored and tired of like random control trials and this stuff.
Yeah. Go read that kind of work.
We'll convert you eventually, but like go read that and
taste the beauty as academic loveliness. Yeah. Like this woman is the like the top of the food chain when it comes to the academic world. And her writing is like something straight out of poetry. It's beautiful and magical. So Claire Wills.
May we not divorce from our embodied creativity.
Exactly. No need. Scientists and poets. Yes, please. All right. Thank you guys for listening. We hope you enjoyed this at least half as much as we enjoy talking about it. Thanks for listening to this episode. Find us on our website at beyondhealingcenter.com/media. Also, subscribe to our Patreon to support us at patreon.com/beyondhealingcenter. Find all episodes on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks for listening.